From Cafe and the Vox Media Podcast Network, welcome to Cafe Insider. I'm Preet Bharara.
And I'm Joyce Vance.
How are you, Joyce?
I'm doing well, Preet. How are you doing? Anything interesting going on this morning?
So you're going to have to carry me a little bit.
Honey, I've been carrying you for a long time.
That is no argument for me there. That is certainly true. So we've been recording, both of us, and mostly doing television from our homes. And it's pretty quiet where I live, except that yesterday, my immediate next door neighbor has decided to replace the roof of his home. That causes some extraneous noise. So we'll see how much banging and stapling noises there are.
I really love that this is happening on your end, because usually it's me who I'm sitting in my chair in my home studio to do TV, and a cat jumps out of the ceiling into my lap or something. So I am really glad it's you.
At least you keep the chickens out.
I actually have had chickens in here on occasion.
Not during the taping of this show.
I had baby chicks in here for 2 weeks while we were doing the podcast. You just couldn't hear them.
Wow.
Yeah. I need to dig. I'll dig up pictures.
I have one bit of exciting news for folks who live in the New York area or want to come to the New York area. I will be in live conversation with Representative Adam Schiff, chairman of the Intel Committee, about the state of affairs in Washington and his new book. You know, he's got a new book.
I have
Midnight
it.
In Washington.
I do.
Yeah. Midnight in Washington, How We Almost Lost Our Democracy and Still Could. That's Thursday, November 18th at 7 p.m. at Cooper Union in New York City. There's a link to sign up free in the show notes. And if you can't make it or don't live in New York City, you can listen to the interview and stay tuned the following week. So Adam Schiff is going to be in the house.
I am looking forward to that. That's going to be a great interview.
We'll see. I don't believe that the buildings surrounding Cooper Union will be having their roofs redone during that conversation. At
least you can only hope.
I think the sound quality will be fine. What should we talk? So we should talk about probably a few things. One of which is the ongoing investigation by the January 6th committee. More subpoenas, more balking at subpoenas, more litigation. You know, I think we're slowly but surely getting there. Which development do you want to talk about first? Joyce, it's up to you.
You know, I have the sense that this January 6th select committee is for real. So let's start by talking about these new subpoenas last night. That's sort of the end of the story. But I think it's interesting. There are six new subpoenas issued last night to folks who were pretty close to Trump in the whole January 6th event. And the question is, what's going on here? You know, I initially thought the committee was putting pressure on DOJ to enforce the Bannon subpoena by putting in a second wave of subpoenas. But a good friend, a DOJ lawyer, suggested to me that perhaps it means the committee has confidence that DOJ will enforce that subpoena. What do you think, and what do you make of these subpoenas?
Well, that's sort of interesting. We should mention who the six subpoenas are directed towards. Bill Stepien, who was a manager of the Trump 2020 reelection campaign. Jason Miller, senior advisor to that campaign. Angela McCallum, also an assistant to the campaign. John Eastman, you've been hearing us talk about, outside lawyer, who wrote that memo for Pence to follow to overturn the election. I think one of the extreme villains of this whole thing. Michael Flynn, we've talked about a million times.
Former national security advisor.
Oh my gosh, have fun with that. And Bernard Carrick, who used to be the police commissioner in New York, I think we talked about him recently.
We did. We talked about his role in
the
war
Hotel.
Room. Yeah.
So, yeah, I think they're serious. I guess one question that a layperson might have is, if you know all the people that are on the list that you want to talk to and you want to be comprehensive and thorough, why are subpoenas issued in batches? You know, six now, you know, 10 the other day, a few a week or two ago. You know, why doesn't a committee just issue 45 subpoenas right at the outset?
So I think that's such a good question, and I think that there are at least two reasons. One is just practical. From a management point of view, you want to schedule a series of interviews and bring people in a manageable fashion. But there's a much more substantive reason underlying these tranches of witnesses. And I suspect that that is that you want to hear from witnesses and learn about what they know, get whatever documents that they have, test their stories, as you move further on up the chain. I was interested, I heard Adam Schiff last night on the Lawrence O'Donnell show, and he was asked about why the committee hadn't subpoenaed Rudy Giuliani yet.
So I wouldn't read too much into the fact that he was not on this list. We're deeply interested in Mr. Giuliani and his pivotal role in this plot to overturn the election, because obviously he was deeply involved in these bogus legal cases brought around the country, and he has very important information the committee wants.
I think that's the strategy here.
Right. There's some witnesses you can talk to earlier because you know sort of the timeline and the story and you have the documents. And there are other witnesses that you want to talk to after you've talked to certain preliminary witnesses, which is basically, I just repeated what you just said.
Yeah. Kay, can I ask you an important question before we move on? I mean, we've got these six witnesses. I'm not sure if we mentioned that Bill Stepien came from Chris Christie's Bridgegate operation, right? Which is an intriguing detail.
Right.
What band name would you give these six witnesses altogether?
Oh, gosh. Quiet Riot? Wow.
Yeah, I think that's
actually
pretty
perfect. I was thinking about Quiet Riot the other day.
Quiet Riot's good.
For reasons that are not really important. You know, heavy metal, folks who don't know, heavy metal band from the 80s, maybe they were past the 80s, but I knew them as a young kid in New Jersey. Did my math homework to Quiet Riot and Def Leppard. That's a fact, maybe.
I would have never guessed.
It wasn't just Bruce.
Wow.
There was also some metal going on.
Well, now I'm so glad I asked.
We'll see which of these folks in the ongoing saga will come and speak. We'll try to negotiate parameters for coming and speaking to the committee, and which won't. But we already know about some of the prior folks. And one development I think is worth talking about is Jeffrey Clark. Remember, Jeffrey Clark was a former acting assistant attorney general for the civil division who was going behind the back of the acting attorney general, Jeff Rosen, seems to have been communicating directly with Donald Trump about ways to help overturn the result in Georgia. He was issued a subpoena. And he took a somewhat different tack, not completely, but somewhat different tack from Steve Bannon. We'll come back to Steve Bannon in a moment. So Jeffrey Clark actually physically shows up to the hearing room with his lawyer. So there's a lot of anticipation. What's he going to do? But when he shows up, he doesn't say anything substantive in response to the questions. He invokes attorney-client privilege. Explain to folks why, and I have my theory also, why someone shows up if they're not going to speak.
Because they don't want to go to jail. That's my short answer. You know, this is the way that you assert privilege. You have to show up. You have to appear. There are preliminary questions like, what's your name, that don't fall within the privilege. And then you assert the privilege a question at a time. And when it becomes clear 5, 6, 10 questions in that your answer over and over is the privilege, that's the point at which the hearing or whatever the inquiry is suspended to work out the privilege issues. So it looks like that's what happened here. I confess to feeling eternally disappointed that there's not a single good man in the Trump orbit who's willing to come forward and tell the truth, even at this late date. I didn't have much hope that that person would be Clark, given his history, but it would have been stunning to see a John Dean-like moment from this particular witness.
What's weird is, with Jeffrey Clark, is that he happens to be a witness about whom Trump himself and his lawyers have not asserted privilege, right? So in the case of certain documents like Steve Bannon's communications, they have. Here you've got a guy from the Justice Department that the president's folks have basically said, yeah, we're not going to really object here. So that's peculiar. The other thing that's peculiar is his other colleagues, higher ranking officials in the Justice Department, including Acting Attorney General Jeffrey Rosen, who I mentioned, have already been voluntarily before the committee and testified at great length. And I keep wondering, you know, how do you square those things? And Jeffrey Clark's lawyer, in a letter to the committee, attempts to address it, and I don't think it's a very good argument, but at least he acknowledges it, the elephant in the room. Quote, I am aware that other former top officials in the Department of Justice have provided testimony to Congress, despite the former president's assertion of privilege and despite the failure of the conditions in this other letter that they reference. They go on to say, quote, be that as it may, in the present circumstances, the fact that other former officials may have testified rightly or wrongly at the time does not change Mr. Clark's obligations in light of the recent positions taken by former President Trump in a particular letter, which is weird because Trump did not take the position that Clark shouldn't testify. Is that a good argument or not?
If I understand Clark's argument correctly, it's that the privilege exists because Trump doesn't say it does, which, as you point out, is not sensible. Look, there are two things underlying this that I'm interested in your reaction to. The first is why Trump didn't assert the privilege to prevent his former acting attorney general, Jeff Rosen, from testifying. I have a thought about that. I'd like to hear yours. And then the second issue, you know, is this. Clark tries to assert attorney-client privilege as well, somehow mixed into this weird argument he's crafting. And the argument that they seem to make is that the president is entitled to advice of his lawyers and of all presidential appointees in the executive branch. Clark is one of them. But this runs contrary to all of my DNA as a DOJ lawyer. My job as a DOJ lawyer, my line of allegiance is up to the attorney general, and I don't separately advise the president or any other executive branch employee absent some sort of an understanding with the attorney general. Clark's effort to cut him out here, I find this to be disingenuous at best and really disgusting at worst.
And what you say goes double when the issue on which you're presumably providing advice is a campaign issue and how to win an election, right?
Exactly.
DOJ lawyers are not in the employ directly of the president.
It's a Hatch Act violation in addition to everything else if what he says is true. So why do you think Trump doesn't assert the privilege to keep Rosen from talking to the select committee?
No idea. I mean, I've had that question in my head for weeks now, and I've asked other people who are smart, and I don't have the answer because, you know, what's weird about the Trump team and its lawyers is they take these extreme scorched earth positions on so many occasions, right? Nothing about the 1-6 inquiry is legitimate. There's no legislative purpose there. When they were fighting over the documents that the Manhattan DA was trying to get, they took the position that it's all privileged. You can't get anything. Very, very extreme positions that in many cases have been mocked by the courts. In the election cases, obviously, they lost, I think, 61 out of 62. They took extreme positions, scorched earth positions. So if you're going to do that, why don't you do that across the board? I still think it would have ultimately failed, but I don't have an answer to your question. Why is it that they just sort of blithely let Jeffrey Rosen go and testify? I'm glad it happened, but why they allowed that? I don't know. I guess one answer is incompetence. They weren't paying attention at the time. You know, I don't get it because on every other occasion, they say, no, 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 no. Why are they letting something slip through?
I wonder, just pure speculation, no insider knowledge, if Rosen might not have let them know that he intended to testify, even if they asserted the privilege. One way that he could have done that would be by acknowledging, you know, that there was some sort of crime fraud exception that would have allowed him to testify regardless. And that would have been fairly devastating for Trump if his former attorney general had said that.
Well, he came in very early. So I don't know how quickly the Trump team had their ducks in a row. We're now only, you know, a couple of months in. I remember exactly when the committee was formed. But his testimony is almost ancient, going back many, many weeks.
It is, but there was some suggestion that the Trump folks were aware in advance of it, which is why I've hesitated to attribute this to sheer incompetence. But with the Trump folks, that is always possible.
Now, with respect to this big tranche of documents from the National Archives, there's still litigation and fighting about that. We should talk about that for a minute. What I think is important to stress is this issue that we always talk about, whether we're talking about the abortion case in Texas or anything else, the sort of status quo and the default thing that will happen but for legal intervention is important to understand. Sometimes the status quo favors disclosure, sometimes it favors non-disclosure. Right now, the posture of the case is that the National Archives will release all these documents because there's no objection from the sitting president, and it's the sitting president who is in the best position, the courts say, and OLC opinions say, to figure out what should or should not be shielded from public view. The National Archives is planning to release these documents on November 12th. That's this Friday, unless a court stops them. So if a court is delayed, doesn't have an opinion, doesn't have a decision, the Archives is not waiting for a blessing from the court to release documents. It's releasing documents unless it's told not to, right?
That's right. And first off, we should say all hail to the lawyers for National Archives who ruined the image of federal employees every place by filing their brief in this matter early morning on Saturday. I mean, when do government lawyers ever do that? But that's the reality. As you point out, these documents will be released unless the judge intervenes and says no. And there's some suggestion that she might. I mean, I think this is an interesting aspect of diversity on the federal bench. You've got a former defense lawyer in Judge Chutkan, and she looks at the government's request for, or rather at the House's request for documents and says, wow, this is overbroad. And so there's some sense that around the edges, she may impose some limits. But by and large, she seemed inclined to permit the release. She seemed to believe that this was not an absolute privilege, executive privilege, and that ultimately, when there's a dispute between a current and a former president, that you should give a lot of grace to the views of the current president.
Yeah, look, I think the judge in the case is very clear that she finds the arguments being made by the Trump folks not to release these documents to be not in good faith and to be without merit. I mean, she says at one point, quote, the January 6th riots happened in the Capitol. That is literally Congress's house. And she asks, are you really saying that the president's notes, talking points, and telephone conversations on January 6th, for example, have no relation to matters on which Congress is considering legislation? So I think her position is clear. The issue you talked about with respect to the overbroad claim she made about some of the things that the committee is looking for is a function of, I think, the following, right? And I think the committee has some work to do to try to explain the breadth of their requests. And I think this is important to the overall theme and work of the committee. So on the one hand, all the stuff relating to January 6th itself, right? The notes from that day, who was doing the planning, what conversations were being had at the Willard Hotel nearby, the war room, all of that is very clear and clearly falls within the ambit of what should be released. That's all good and proper, and I think they're going to get all of that. The problem is, the theory of the case is, you know, the bad stuff didn't begin on January 6th or just a few days leading up to January 6th. It's the culmination of a long period of time of dwelling on this big lie and perpetrating the big lie. And so the origin story of this, from the committee's perspective, and I think from a reasonable perspective, goes back months to before the election, when even in the early to midsummer of 2020, there were conversations being had and communications about perpetrating ultimately a big lie if Trump was seen to have lost. It's on those things that are more attenuated from January 6th itself, from that actual insurrection, that the judge expresses some skepticism, right? They're looking for polling information, other stuff. Is that fair on her part?
I think it is. The polling information was where I thought she lost faith with the House lawyer, Doug Leder, former DOJ appellate lawyer who now represents the House. And he valiantly explained to her that they wanted to see the polling data because they wanted to be able to establish that the campaign then reacted to the polling data, and that much of the origin of the big lie comes as a response to negative polling data. That seemed a bit attenuated. That seemed to be the point where Judge Chutkan began to express some reservations.
I think it's okay, too. I mean, you've had cases like this. An assistant would come to my office, a prosecutor would come to my office and say, you know, there's a motion to suppress. It's got some teeth to it. And the question you always ask is, well, how bad is it for the case if it gets suppressed? And sometimes it's devastating on one end of the spectrum, and you have to dismiss the case. For example, if it's a felon in possession gun case and the gun is suppressed, you're pretty much out of luck. But sometimes it's something tangential. So on this, in a parallel way, if they don't get some of this older material from the prior summer, the polling data, I don't think that's going to have a particular negative impact on their ability to figure out what happened and to have transparency, right?
And honestly, wouldn't you be a little bit disappointed with the House lawyers if their request wasn't slightly overbroad?
That's an excellent point. Explain what you mean by that.
You know that you're going to get slimmed down a little bit in this process.
You ask for the moon a little
bit, right? I think you do. You ask for everything that you want. And honestly, Doug Leder's argument for why they needed the polling data was excellent, and he could just as easily win on it because it was a narrowly crafted argument. I think what it does, though, is when you get to stuff like the draft of the president's speech at the rally on the Ellipse the morning of January 6th, it makes the case for that sort of information so much clearer. And beyond that, something, Preet, that we've talked about a lot is anything that involves the campaign is beyond the scope of executive privilege. Really, the argument is whether it's responsive to the work that Congress is doing with this select committee. It may well be that this was cleverly done strategically to let the judge draw a line about what's too attenuated, but what the committee gets to see, because ultimately this case doesn't die here. I have a sense that this goes to the Supreme Court in the sense that either they look at it and they decline to respond, they decline cert and say, no, this isn't something we need to look at, and it ends there with the appellate court ruling. But they could decide to write to the issue of first impression here.
But, and this is sort of, I think, an interesting tactical issue, if what we said before was correct, that the posture of the case is, unless a court intervenes, this stuff is getting out. Even if there's an appeal, unless that appeal can be taken and an appellate court can take some action, before this Friday, the information is getting released, right?
That's right. And the judge in the hearing said that she would expedite her ruling. She said that she was cognizant of those deadlines and would go ahead and expedite.
But if you are the judge, let me ask you this question. You know, it's kind of like at the end of a football game, if you have possession or you don't have possession, you're making decisions about, you know, whether you're running the ball or not, right, to run out the clock. Is this judge gaming it out and considering rendering her opinion like on Friday morning so there's insufficient time for an appellate court to take some action? Or could we see it this afternoon, you know, before the podcast hits the interwebs later this afternoon? Like, how do you think about the timing of it? Is it possible for the judge to rule in the way that we predict and yet some other action be taken between now and Friday?
So I think there's always time for an appellate court to rule. If I'm the judge, I'm cognizant of that, and I would get my ruling out no matter what way I came down to foreclose an argument by the Trump lawyers that they hadn't had time to evaluate that ruling and appeal, which might convince the D.C. Circuit to issue sort of a prophylactic stay, to say, no, National Archives, you can't release the documents until we sort this out. If she, for instance, rules today or tomorrow—
I bet it comes out today. You know why?
Why do you think today?
Because we record our podcast in the morning and it comes out in the evening.
That makes
and
sense.
And it's just, that's how it works.
Yeah, that makes total sense to me. And also, you know, Thursday is Veterans Day, right? Is it Thursday?
Yes. Yeah,
and,
it is.
And so late last night, the Trump lawyers, who had apparently woken up to this calendaring reality, they file a late night motion asking the judge to actually enter an injunction, sort of like they've looked into their crystal ball. They know she's going to rule against them. And they say, judge, you know, please go ahead and enter an injunction now. And the judge very tastefully, in what's called a minute order response, just sort of a notation on her docket, notes that there is no jurisdiction to enter an injunction before she has ruled. And she says, Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 62D allows temporary injunctive relief while an appeal is pending from an interlocutory order or final judgment. This court has not yet entered any such interlocutory order or final judgment, and thus a request for relief under Rule 62D, which plainly requires an interlocutory order or final judgment before considering such motions, is premature. It is such a nice
slap. I like the way you read that. I like the way you read that.
Oh, man, I read it the way she wrote it. I mean, this is just such a such a appellate law 101 mistake, right? There's just no jurisdiction, even if she wanted to enter an injunction.
There's a fine line, Joyce, between mistake and Hail Mary pass.
And this is just showing that you don't understand how practice works. This was not a Hail Mary pass.
Last thing on January 6th we should talk about, because we may have some disagreement on this. Not a lot, but maybe a little bit. Steve Bannon. Everyone wants to know, why has Steve Bannon not been indicted? We have on the show talked about the history of criminal contempt of Congress. There was the case from the early 80s where there was a 9-day period from the time of the referral from Congress to the DOJ to the indictment. Didn't work out for the government ultimately, but it didn't take very long. And I've seen you on social media address the question that listeners have, you know, what's taking so long? Shouldn't this be very quick? I think it should be quite quick. I think it's very simple. The grand jury presentation itself, because in the federal court, you can use hearsay. You could do it in an hour, maybe less, maybe a little bit more. You think there's a good reason why it's taking some time. What's that?
I am glad for DOJ to take whatever time it needs to secure the case before it indicts. I don't think that that's a matter of months, by the way. But They may need to use the grand jury to obtain some of the evidence that they want to use in admissible form. And you know, like I do, that takes some time.
Yeah, but that's true. I mean, I've been trying to figure out what that evidence is. There's no financial information. There's no bank information. They don't need emails. Steve Bannon has information. He defied the subpoena. I don't know what sort of collateral things. I might be missing something, but I don't know what kind of collateral things you need to make a determination about that.
I actually don't think you're missing anything. I just suspect that there's stuff that we don't know that could lead to delay. The other thing is there are a couple of defenses here. There's this executive privilege defense. It's not a good one. And then there's also advice of counsel that Bannon's relying on the advice of his lawyer in not appealing. I think that they're both bad defenses. Prosecutors need to take the time to work through them. They may even need to have a meeting with Bannon's lawyers before they indict. This is a case where you dot all your I's and cross all your T's. So as long as they don't take too long, I'm willing to give them the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah, not too long. Maybe that'll happen this afternoon too.
Today is on my betting pool.
I can predict that something significant in the world of law and the Constitution is going to happen this afternoon. To render some of what we talked about overtaken by events. So we'll be following all of that, and I think a lot of interesting things will happen. You know, these documents have a great likelihood of being released to the committee this Friday, and so we'll be talking about that almost certainly next week. The trial of the three men charged with the killing of Ahmaud Arbery continues. There's some interesting things to talk about there. Opening statements happened. There's been a little bit of testimony. What do you make of how that trial is going so far?
So let me just issue this general caveat. I think unless you're in the courtroom hearing all of the evidence, it can be very hard to get a sense of where these trials are going. That's something I was very appreciative of in the trial of Derek Chauvin, that we got to watch everything firsthand as it happened.
I echo that. I'm sure you had trials that the media and the public was following when you were U.S. attorney. And sometimes the public got it all wrong because they just got snippets. There might have been like one day of sensational testimony on one side or the other, and people drew conclusions about that. Unless you're there seeing piece by piece the evidence come in, you have no idea.
I think that's absolutely right. So I listened. I was able to see most of the opening statements in this case. I was incredibly impressed by the prosecutor. She had this very approachable, almost folksy style that you see good prosecutors adopt down here in the South. Maybe y'all don't do that in New York, in the big city. But she
We're folksy. We try to be folksy.
She was really good. She did, I thought, just this extraordinary layout of the evidence. A lot of her evidence is on videotape, and it was very compelling. You know, in opening statement, your job as a prosecutor isn't to argue the evidence. It's in essence to predict to the jury what the evidence will be and give them some context for what they're about to hear. She did a fabulous job.
So that's a good point you make. And so for our lay listeners who are becoming experts in getting half a law degree by listening to us every week,
it's at least three quarters.
When you hear a member of the media or an analyst say opening argument, change the channel, because it's not an opening argument. In fact, argument is not allowed. Argument is what happens at the end of the case. When you ask them to draw conclusions from the things that were said and the evidence that was introduced, opening statement, opening statement, opening statement, not opening argument. If you argue in an opening statement, that's objectionable, and what you say can be stricken. But people love to say opening argument. Can't do it.
Something interesting happened in these opening statements, though, that we talked about.
Everyone who watches TV knows, or if you're an actual lawyer who's tried cases, in almost all jurisdictions, in a criminal case, the prosecution makes an opening statement, and then the defense, and if there are multiple defendants, each defendant's lawyer has an opportunity to make an opening statement, and then the case comes in, and then the defense can present a case or not, and their closing arguments at the end. There is nothing that requires any lawyer to make any opening statement of any kind. And in particular, a defense lawyer, and this is true also under the law in Georgia, if the defense lawyer waives making an opening statement, meaning decides to decline to give an opening statement, you can reserve that right until the government has put in its entire case, called all its witnesses, there's been cross-examination. At the end of the government's case, when it's time for the defense to go, a defense lawyer can make an opening statement at that time. And one of the lawyers in this case, remember, there are three people charged. There's the father and the son, and then the person who was driving the car and taking the video. That person's lawyer just a wave opening statement, which our friend Katie Fang wondered why the judge thought that was so crazy, because the judge said, I need to research this. I've never heard of such a thing. It's very, very unusual. I think it's more unusual in federal court than in state court. I can remember one or two instances when I heard about it in the Southern District of New York for various reasons that I'm happy to talk about because I think it's kind of interesting. It doesn't make a lot of strategic sense to me. What do you think?
So I can remember three times in 25 years, which is to say, I think you're right, it's rare in federal court. Katie spends a lot of time in state court in Florida, and I think that her comment is more accurate about what goes on in state court. But it's worth noting that the judge had never seen this happen before, had to take a recess and go look it up, and in a rare moment of humility for a judge, came back and acknowledged that he was not an encyclopedia. So I thought it was nice to see that human moment from a
state court judge. There's that Georgia rule. We have a crack staff.
There you go.
Georgia Courts Rule 10.2 that says very clearly the judge shouldn't have taken 15 minutes.
No, it should have been in his bench notes, but whatever. So you ask, though, if it's a good strategy. I think in context here, it was actually a pretty good call. There are two other defendants. Their lawyers make opening statements. So the jury is hearing in some sense.
And so this, you get the benefit, you get the spillover effect of the benefit. But let me ask you a different hypothetical, because I knew you were going to say that because you're very smart. If he had been the only defendant, if you're a solo defendant, does the strategy calculation shift?
It's more risky, especially in a long trial like this. It lets the prosecution potentially go for a couple of weeks with no hint other than cross-examination of the defendant's response. But the defendant whose lawyer decided to use this strategy is Roddy Bryant. He's the guy who just shows up out of nowhere, starts videoing it, and I mean, essentially, I'm going to characterize my take on his role in this case. He just said, oh, if there's going to be a lynching, I want to be a part of it. You know, he just sort of jumps on with no prior interaction with Mr. Arbery, and he's all in on using his truck to trap and corner Mr. Arbery, and is apparently so unabashed about it that he keeps the whole thing on video. So if I'm his lawyer, I really need to hear how the prosecution's evidence goes in and how they're going to characterize my client's role. And then I can have a much more narrowly tailored opening statement after the government has already had its say.
The way I think about this is less legal and more psychological. I mean, one of the introductory lectures that I chose to give to incoming prosecutors at SDNY was the one on opening statements, actually, and also closing arguments. From a psychological perspective, whatever side you represent, you want to make a good and solid and strong impression on the jury right off the bat. And a lot of good defense lawyers don't really say a lot about the facts of the case. They'll get up and they simply humanize and introduce their client, make sure the jury understands this is a human being with a family and with a life and with a future. And it's a very heavy thing to decide to pronounce a verdict of guilty on a fellow human being. And they also make sure to emphasize what reasonable doubt means, that the government has a really, really high burden, and to also appear to be likable and trustworthy and credible to the jury. And so in most instances, and I have one caveat on this that I'll mention in a moment, but in most instances, to forego the opportunity to bond with the jury and make them understand both that you are a lawyer to be trusted and to pay attention to when you cross-examine the government's witnesses, and likable, and that your client is a human being. To forego that opportunity at a human level seems to be silly to me. Now, when I was talking about this with Katie, because you know she brought it up in that tweet that she sent, one other thing that's different between federal practice and state practice, at least between the SDNY and state practice as I understand it, is in state court, and I'm sure this is true in Georgia, the lawyers do get an opportunity to have a lot of back and forth with the jury during jury selection. And so there's, you know, the lawyers themselves engage in voir dire. They have an opportunity to talk a little bit about what the facts of the case might be, to show themselves to be folksy, like the prosecutor you said was. And so maybe there's less of a need because you have had some communication with and bonding with the jurors who sit on the panel ultimately, that you don't need that opportunity. In federal court, I mean, literally, for an assistant U.S., the first time that the jury hears what your voice sounds like is in the opening statement. Because in virtually all cases in SDNY, I don't know if this is true in your district, the voir dire is conducted by the judge.
So it's interesting. For us, it varies by judge. And typically even the judges that conduct the voir dire themselves, they let you submit questions and then they ask them. Even those judges will let you have a little bit of follow-up. And a good defense lawyer can make a lot of hay in just a very few questions. But you're right. In Georgia, in state court, the lawyers get to do a lot of it. They have that bonding experience with jurors, which can be critically important. And if you're a good defense lawyer, when you're qualifying the jury and picking your jurors, you will extract a commitment from the jurors that they will hold the government to its burden of proof and that they will give your client a fair hearing no matter how bad it looks at the outset. So I'm sort of intrigued, frankly, by the strategy that the lawyer took here.
I don't even know what that looks like at the end, particularly in a case where you're not going to present a defense. So the government gives the opening statement, they put on their case, they call witnesses, they get cross-examined, the government rests. Then the lawyer who has waived the opening statement gets up and I guess can give an opening statement then. But I presume that the rules of opening statements persist. And even though there's been, right, so it's odd then to be handicapped by the rule that you can't argue. So now all this evidence has come in, the jury has questions. Well, how do you explain X? How do you explain Y? How do you explain the difference between what was on the videotape and what the, you know, utterances of the defendant were at the crime scene? It's a little bit harder to do if you're just talking about what the evidence you expect will show because the evidence has already come in. And then if there's no defense case, maybe there will be in this case, but if there's no defense case, that one defendant gives his opening statement. Then the government gives its closing statements, and then that defendant's lawyer gives his closing statement kind of close in time. I may be missing something, so folks who practice in this area, you should write in and let us know.
I mean, we just don't know, right? But I suspect that there will be a defense. The defense is going to be self-defense and the use of this Georgia citizen's arrest statute.
So expert testimony, you think?
You know, I don't know what it's going to look
I don't think
like.
These guys are getting on the stand. You think the defendants are getting on the stand?
I wouldn't let any of these guys get on the stand.
Yeah. So what other witnesses would there be?
I don't know, Preet. It's a really good question. We're going to have to wait and see. Often the strategy in a case like this is simply to hold the government to its burden of proof. So I could see that as a possibility. No proof beyond a reasonable doubt by the government that this wasn't self-defense. But with these videos, that's going to be tough. The defense will try to put in a lot of evidence, as much as they can, about prior interactions between the father and son and Mr. Arbery.
And, you know, to the extent that there are witnesses who can talk about the robberies in the area, which is part of their argument for why they were there and why they were worried and why they thought that Mr. Arbery was dangerous. I guess that you could have witnesses like that. But you mentioned something very important that's going to be a focus of their defense, which I don't know a lot about, and it's the citizen's arrest law, which reminds me a little bit of Florida, you know, in a parallel way about how it can be abused and how it can lead to the death of an innocent person. That's stand your ground law in Florida. Now, the citizen's arrest law was repealed in Georgia after the death of Mr. Arbery.
But it still applies in this case.
But it still applies in this case, yeah. And how's that going to play, you think?
So even if you give that statute its best read, the defendants have to have had a reasonable suspicion that a felony was committed. Really what that's meant to do, if you give the state the benefit of the doubt in enacting that law, because there's some suggestion that it's really a mechanism for recapturing fugitive slaves.
Yeah. No, it's a terrible law. And by the way—
It's an awful law, right? With a horrible history.
Can you answer this question? Is it a citizen's arrest law? And does it have a subpart that allows for citizen's execution?
You know, this is a lynching. When you look at what happened here, this just looks to me like a good old 1950s style, you don't belong in our neighborhood. It's the same as how dare you look at that white woman in the Woolworths. You know, this to me is there's no possible reason a black man should be running through our neighborhood. Something I heard the prosecution say in opening statements that has really intrigued me. They said that the McMichaels, I think one of them, and I don't recall which one, actually had a conversation with law enforcement. You know, there's been this notion that there had been some burglaries in the neighborhood and that Arbery was a suspect. And so the prosecutor says the guy who owns this property, and it's a boat that there had been some stuff burglarized off of, he had put a motion-activated camera in place. And so he was looking at the video in real time. He was in another city. and calling the police. And he actually saw Arbery go in a couple of times, but he never took anything. The prosecution characterized that as a looky-loo. You know, we say that down here. When people go onto construction sites, they're just a looky-loo.
Wait, I'm sorry. Wait.
A looky-loo.
Joyce, wait. A looky what?
Looky-loo.
L-O-U?
L-O-O-K-I-E hyphen L-O. Looky-loo. You know, you take a little looky-loo around the construction site while it's in progress.
I don't know that. I don't know
that
phrase.
The prosecutor was really good. Everybody on the jury,
I suspect,
looky-loo? Shook their head. Yeah, she said it a couple of times. So Arbery is a looky-loo. But on this video, the owner of the property sees another couple. And it does appear to him that they have taken some things. And so law enforcement tells one of the McMichaels, the guy who owns the property doesn't think that Arbery's responsible for the burglaries. I think that piece of information, if that shapes up in testimony, could be really critical.
For the prosecution, yeah. No, absolutely. Now, the other thing that's striking about this case, pun intended, is the way that some jurors were actually unintended, but then when I said it, I wanted to have intended it. if that makes any sense. There's a controversy over the striking of jurors. So the main jury consists of 12 members of the community, 11 white people, and one black person, which is not reflective of the diversity of that community. There's this issue that comes up from time to time. We can explain it very quickly. Both sides have a certain number of challenges. They're called peremptory challenges, where you can remove jurors and say, we don't want them sitting on the jury. And you don't have to give any reason, so long as, per a very, very famous case called Batson v. Kentucky from 1986, so long as your reason is not discriminatory based on race or sex or some other protected class, so long as that is true or not solely on that, you can strike whoever you want. Normally, it's the case, historically, and we've talked about this with respect to a guy who was tried for murder 6 times and made successive Batson challenges. Normally, it's the case that the defense is accusing the prosecution of striking jurors. Here, it's the prosecution, because both sides are entitled to a fair trial. Here, it's the prosecution that challenged a number of strikes of black people from the jury. How often do you see that, and do you think that was a miscarriage in some way?
You know, so you always see it in civil rights cases, and I would categorize this here. Every civil rights case I've ever characterized, I've made a reverse Batson challenge. But here's the problem. The nuance is real different when it's the prosecution that's alleging that the jury selection process is tainted with racial animus. If you're the defendant, you make your Batson challenges, and you've got an issue on appeal if you're convicted. It doesn't work that way if you're the government, right? Because if you lose the case, there is no appeal. Double jeopardy has attached. And beyond
can I tell a quick story about
yeah.
that? Because you make another, to the extent we're trying to educate lay people about the law. There was a federal district court judge who I won't name in the Southern District of New York, which is a hard job to get life tenure and all. And famously, that judge, and it's not completely atypical, had never done criminal work, had done civil litigation in private practice. When one of my fellow prosecutors was arguing about an issue, the judge says to the prosecutor, and this is a sitting federal district court judge with life tenure, says, you've made your record, you can raise it on appeal.
Oh my gosh.
Not understanding the point you just made, which is, it's the end of the road for the prosecution. If the bad ruling results in an acquittal, there's no appeal.
And it's not just the end of the road for the prosecution. If the judge were to give the government the benefit of a Batson strike and remove a juror, it creates some uncertainty under the law whether the defendant would be able to argue, if there was a conviction on appeal, that he was deprived of a proper jury. I think the law suggests that it's not structural error and not directly appealable, but it does involve some litigation risk. So it's not a terrible thing to see a judge being conservative, trying to protect what everyone hopes will be a conviction down the road. By the same token, though, the numbers here are horrible, and this is not unusual, at least in the South in juries. We have the same dynamic here, where you see very few black people, Hispanics, Asians in these jury pools compared to their percentage in the population. That may reflect how the jury pools are drawn. They usually come off of stuff like voting rolls and driver's licenses. because you qualify people. You exclude jurors, for instance, who aren't citizens or in some cases who have criminal convictions. But in this case, the jury that the two sides struck from had 36 white people and 12 black people. And you ended up with 11 white people and one black people at the end on this jury.
So people understand the reason this can happen is the prosecution sees the defense striking, you know, black juror after black juror, and they raise a challenge. And then in response to that, the law makes clear that if the defense, or if it's the other way around, the prosecution, but in this case, the defense, has some, and this is the language of the law, legitimate, non-discriminatory, clear, reasonably specific, and related to the case reason to strike the juror that has nothing to do with their being black or white or anything else, then it's an appropriate strike of the juror. The problem is for various people who talk about this issue and are critical of the effectiveness of the Batson rule that it's pretty toothless because there's lots and lots of ways to articulate a reason apart from race that still may be a pretext because it still may be that you're really trying to get rid of the juror because of their race, but you have this other articulable reason that is maybe more or less persuasive depending on the situation, you can still have a very unbalanced jury like this.
And I think it's baked into the way the Batson process works. So I'm going to be legally very nerdy for a minute. We're in the 11th Circuit in Georgia. And so there's a very deliberate three-step process that the 11th Circuit has established for these sorts of Batson challenges. The reason that this is sort of self-indulgent is because it's actually one of my cases, a 2006 case that I argued. And the court says, here's what has to happen. The party that's making the challenge has to show a prima facie case of animus, of racial animus, or saying that Batson could also apply, for instance, to gender-based strikes. And once the party that objects to the strike makes that showing of animus, then the other party, in this case the defense, has to come forward with race-neutral reasons for strikes. Here's one of the problems in Batson. You can imagine how easy it would be to argue a race-neutral reason. Well, it wasn't that that juror was black. It was that I saw her attention being distracted, and I thought maybe she wouldn't be a good and attentive juror. And so ultimately, the third step of the Batson process is a requirement that the court evaluate the credibility of that neutral, not race-based reason for the strike. And because judges are really concerned about protecting the record on appeal, they want to err in the favor of the defendant. And in this case, that means that they let these strikes of black jurors go through.
So we'll follow what happens in that case. You know, there's so many things to talk about. We can't talk about everything. There's obviously another trial going on of Kyle Rittenhouse that maybe we'll talk about in the future. But I feel like, do you feel like the legal news is accelerating, Joyce?
I think this week has been sort of overwhelming, and it's crazy that both Rittenhouse and Arbery are happening at the same time as the civil trial in Charlottesville over the events there. There's a lot going on specifically in civil rights, criminal, although the Charlottesville case is civil, but it comes out of criminal activity there. So, Preet, we should also talk a little bit about the Durham investigation. You'll recall that John Durham was a Trump-era U.S. attorney in Connecticut, and towards the end of the Trump administration, Bill Barr deputized him as a special prosecutor. This isn't the same type of special prosecutor statute that set Robert Mueller up as the special counsel for the investigation that he conducted. This is a little bit different of a procedure that permits you to put a sitting DOJ employee in place. And Barr was pretty clear about what he was doing. He wanted this Durham investigation to continue into the next administration. And by making the appointment in this way, he made it very difficult for the next attorney general to curtail Durham's work. And in fact, we learned recently from the attorney general, Merrick Garland, that Durham's investigation has been funded for the next year. So this investigation makes me think about that meme that's been going around, how it started, how it's going. You know, this started as an investigation into whether the Crossfire Hurricane investigation into the connection between Russia and the Trump campaign, whether that was a hoax. That was something that Barr wanted to establish. But here's how it's going. We've had now three pretty low-level prosecutions for lying to federal agents. the most recent one came down just this week. It doesn't seem like the Durham investigation is living up to the promise that Barr and even Trump made for it, that it would take down this whole terrible conspiracy, this political witch hunt into the Trump administration.
Yeah, I mean, that may be true. I want to make a couple of things clear from my perspective. And that is, so this gentleman, Igor Danchenko, has been charged with 5 counts, essentially, of making false statements to the FBI. I don't call that a process crime. That's the way in which, when people, you know, on the other side of the aisle would denigrate some of the prosecutions brought by Bob Mueller. I think if it's a material lie in connection with a duly authorized investigation, it's righteous to charge such people. Now, the last case against a gentleman named Mr. Sussman, you and I were critical of because the details of the indictment made the case seem rather thin and there were issues about the materiality. I don't know as much about this. If it is the case that Mr. Danchenko told these lies and he knew them to be lies to the FBI and they relate to representations he made about who his sources were for information that ultimately made its way into the Steele dossier, that's a crime. He should be held accountable and he should be punished. Whether or not overall the Durham investigation is living up to its billing is, I think, a good question. But if he committed the crimes, he should be held accountable for them.
So I agree with that, and I suspect we'll talk about materiality of the statements, but can I just underline what you said about how important these crimes are? It's ironic. I'm teaching obstruction of justice this week to my first-year criminal students.
So teaching them how to do it?
Exactly. Here's how to get in trouble. You know, we've studied perjury. We'll do 1001, which is the charge in this case, tomorrow. And something that I say to them is that these are more than mere process crimes. If you believe that one of the most important goals of the criminal justice system is finding the truth, and I believe that, then these are very important crimes. They're tough to prosecute, but it means that they're righteous. The question that I have here, though, is Danchenko is interviewed in 2017. The indictment suggests from January until maybe early fall, there are some interviews that go on. And the allegation is that he lies about the source of his information in those interviews. Where I'm a little bit stuck on this indictment, and maybe you can help me understand it, is how is that material, right? For this to be criminal conduct, the lies then have to affect the course of the FBI's investigation. And the allegation that I see in the complaint is, well, it caused the FBI to do a lot of work to figure out that Danchenko was lying. And I'm not entirely sure that that rings the bell for materiality.
You know, I don't know. Maybe it's not as clear on materiality as some other cases are. I think when we were in law enforcement, we took a pretty broad view
of what was
material.
But Preet, can I just say this? If this is what materiality means, it made the FBI go do a lot of work to figure out whether it was true or not, I can think of some people like maybe Jared Kushner with his repeated problems with his security clearance, certainly Mike Flynn, who now has a pardon, whose conduct would be far more material if this is the standard that we use.
That's a question about why is something not happening to them, less so.
Fair. That's fair.
Whether this was okay in this case.
It's very ironic that the alleged need for the Durham investigation at its inception was to disclose the political witch hunt, that the allegation was made, all of this investigation into Trump was a political witch hunt. And now on the tail end of this, there's been the suggestion by some members of Congress this week that the Durham investigation should look into some of the folks who were witnesses in Trump's impeachment. And, you know, if you're looking for a political witch hunt, that would appear to be it. So I find there to be considerable irony in that allegation that we've seen on Twitter from members of Congress.
Yeah, and not just members of Congress. One of the, it gets even more sort of circular, if that's what you want to call it. One of the people who is being sought as a witness in the 1-6 investigation, Kash Patel, who's an advisor to President Trump, is himself on the strength or weakness, depending on your perspective, of the most recent Durham indictment, is calling for an investigation of, among other people, Fiona Hill, who was recently a guest on Stay Tuned and was one of the witnesses, as you point out, in the first impeachment trial. And a lot of this looks like, you know, political posturing and retaliation as opposed to good faith interest in getting to the bottom of things.
You know, this is a lengthy indictment, and there's a lot of conversation about Hillary Clinton and the campaign and a lot of people who are not indicted, who are not defendants in this case. And that's typically not how DOJ engages in this conduct. The identity of some folks are masked in this indictment, which is what you and I would do in a case like this. But then there's a lot of conversation that just looks like some political chit-chat to me in this indictment.
So, by the way, I think we did pretty well with my neighbor's roof. There was some clanging. I apologize for that. Just a reminder, everyone, if you're in New York or can make it to New York, very excited to be on stage with Representative Adam Schiff talking about the state of affairs in Washington and his new book, Midnight in Washington. That's Thursday, November 18th, just 9 days away at 7 p.m. at the Great Cooper Union in New York City. Sign up for free at the link in the show notes. And if you can't make it, he'll be the episode the following week of Stay Tuned. Send us your questions and thoughts to letters@cafe.com.
We really do appreciate your questions and even more your insights. We look forward to answering and sharing them.
That's it for this week. Cafe Insider is presented by Cafe Studios and the Vox Media Podcast Network. Your hosts are Preet Bharara and Joyce Vance. The executive producer is Tamara Sepper. The technical director is David Tatasciore. The senior producers are Adam Waller and Matthew Billy. And the Cafe team is David Curlander, Sam Ozer-Staten, Noah Azulai, Nat Wiener, Jake Kaplan, Chris Boylan, Sean Walsh, Chelsea Simmons, and Namita Shah. Our music is by Andrew Das. Thank you for being a part of the Cafe Insider community.